put some of that in your coffee. I don't even like sweet coffee, but I like sweetened condensed milk, and that's bad. Especially if you're diabetic, doesn't it? While we're all getting ready, when I was in Swaziland, Africa, they drink tea. They don't drink iced tea, by the way. They disdain that. But when they serve their tea, and for some reason, I remember the brand name of the tea that they served. It was Three Roses. And we had some of them come over here and visit our home, and they informed us that Lipton tea was not made for hot tea. So anyway, that's what they did. They stuck their spoon down in a container of sweetened condensed milk, and they twisted it and got all that that spoon would hold on it, and that's what they dissolved in their cup of tea. And I can tell you that that's addictive. It really is. Truly is. It becomes an addiction. We are... Let me raise this thing up one notch. If I can get it to catch. I may have made a mistake. I'm going to have to hold this the whole class here. There it is. Okay. We're in Romans chapter 6, verse 7. Remember, Romans 6 and 7 is outlined in three questions and three answers. Chapter 6, verse 1 is the first question. Shall we continue in sin that grace may increase? Answer was what? No. Why? You died to sin. And the rest, all the way to chapter 6, verse 14, is an explanation of when, where, and how you died to sin. And the short answer to that is, when did you die to sin? When you were baptized. That's what he says. You participate in the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And then he asks a second question, and he ends that argument with verse 14. For sin shall not be your master, because you're not under law but under grace. That's in 6:14. And that provides you a two-point outline for the next two questions. Look at verse 14 again. If for sin shall not be your master, because you're not under law but you're under grace. So we need to talk about those two things, not being under law and being under grace. And those are two different topics. That's not the same thing. Now, they dovetail together, but it's two different topics that we need to discuss. Not being under law, and then secondly, being under grace. What does it mean, not being under law? Does it mean that we're lawless people? Does it mean we go out and do anything we want to do? Well, verse 15, he made the statement, you're not under law, in verse 15 through 23, he responds to, you are not under law. And beginning in chapter 7, verse 1 through verse 6, he's responding to the second half of that verse, but under grace. And so if you want to find out something about what it means to not be under law, then you go to those verses, verse 15 to 23. If you want to find out something about what it means to be under grace, then you go to chapter 1, verse 1 through 7. Okay, you with me? And so now, he's having said, you back up, 6:1, shall we continue sinning that grace may increase? And he's going to answer that all the way down to verse 14, 1 through 14. And he ends that answer with two statements. Sin will not be your master. That's the key. Why? Because you're not under law, but you're under grace. And by the way, I don't do this real often, but I say this every time I go to another verse, because I want you to know we're studying Romans, and I'm not really trying to bring in everything supporting in the New Testament, but you realize we could stay on you're not under law for the next 6 months, very easily. And by the way, it would be time well spent. because I'm pretty convinced that one of the things that we've not spent much time on in the Lord's church is talking about our relationship to law. And I think we really need to spend some time talking about our relationship to law. And it will give us a real basis for understanding and appreciating grace. And law. And why God gave law. And what law was intended to accomplish. Now, we spent a pretty good bit of time doing that at the very beginning of our study back a long time ago. But we're, if you hold your finger right there, the phrase, you are not under law. And in order to kind of get us underway, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 15, verse 56. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 56. And I've read this passage just like you have. It's about the resurrection. And the whole chapter, 1 Corinthians 15, is about the resurrection. But he slips a real zinger in here. And you'll miss it. And I missed it for years and years. And then when I read it and said, wow, what is that doing here in this discussion about the resurrection? Why would he put that in there? But look at verse 56 of 1 Corinthians 15. The sting of death is sin. And the power of sin is what? Law. Now, folks, I'm telling you, that takes some thinking. The power of sin. Just like the stinger of death is sin, then in a very real parallel, in that same way, the power of sin is the law. The law, our sin, gets its power from law. Now, could we spend some time talking about how that's true and why that's true and what that means? But I just put that out there for your consideration here. All right, we're not going to study that whole concept right there. But you really need to bring that thought into your understanding at some point of our relationship to law. And up to this point, everything that we've read about law tends to cause us to think, man, we need to get rid of law. Law's been our problem all along here. If we could just get rid of law, we'd be in good shape. And that's a pretty good illustration of it's not in man that walks to direct his own steps, because that is exactly the opposite of the truth. Now, the problem that we have with law is we've tried to take law and use it to do something that law cannot do. We've tried to justify ourselves with law. And it was never intended to be used for that purpose. But it's hard to get away from that. Because that's what the natural man wants to do. Because if you can feel like you can justify yourself by keeping law, then you can feel good about yourself. And who in the world doesn't like to feel good about ourselves? And does my self-image good if I feel like that I can save myself by being good? But there's one problem. You keep trying and keep trying and keep trying, and at some point, if you're honest, you come to the realization, no, I can't. And as hard as I try, I'm not able to. And that's where we're going in chapter 7. But we're not there yet. We're in chapter 6. We're in chapter 7, verse 6. So as we come down and see the first part of verse 14 of 6, we're not under law. We looked at that a couple of weeks ago. 7, 1 through 6, we're under grace. And so now that we come to the end of that part, verse 6, he says, but now by dying to what once bound us. What is it that once bound us? Law. We have been released from law. So, go back to verse 14. Keep going back as you study this back to verse 14. Sin shall not be your master. That's what this whole section right here. Now, by dying to what once bound us, and again, we know when we died, we have been released from the law so that we serve in newness of spirit, literally, and not in oldness of that which is written. You got it? And if you want to cross-reference 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 6 there, it's a good verse. Well, I'm not going there, but if you want to write that down for yourself and go study that. I think I gave you some other verses last time. Now, the third question is in verse 7. And we're at that point now where he talks about, you know, this. We've just hammered law, and we've seen the downside of law. And so our thought is, boy, we need to get rid of law. And so he asks, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? And that's where, if we've been following this argument, then it's a very real possibility that's going to be our conclusion. The law has been the problem all along. And so we need to get rid of law. But he says, far from it. No. The answer to every one of these questions has been what? No. Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? No. Shall we sin because we're not under law but under grace? No. Is the law sin? No. But see, our argument would lead us to tend to want to say yes to every one of these. And so we really need to pay attention to the arguments and why the answer is no rather than yes. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Far from it. And then he begins to tell you why the law is not a bad thing, why it's not sin. For I would not have known what sin was except through the law, for I would not have known what it was to covet if the law had said, do not covet. Now, we talked a little bit one time, I think, about what, it's kind of a puzzle of why, of all of the principles in the law, or all the laws, would he choose that one? Thou shalt not covet. Anybody have any thoughts before I launch into my thoughts? Anybody have any thoughts of why would he have, of all the laws, why would he have chosen thou shalt not covet? Okay. Okay. Yeah. You think it's possible that we, let's just say the natural man, apart from God's law, it just wouldn't seem like that big a deal to covet. It just wouldn't seem, as Dan said, it wouldn't seem to be that harmful that I would want something that somebody else has. And so it might be that that particular principle of law is one that is kind of not real obvious. But maybe the reality is that may be the root of all of them. If you really go back and analyze, why do you kill? Where do you think it started? Yeah, you coveted something. Now, it could be positive or negative. It was something you wanted. And this person foiled your plans in some way or other. And we could probably spend lots of time trying to think and digging deeper, but I think it's at least possible that he picked this one out because it's not so obvious. Murder's pretty obvious, right? Adultery's pretty obvious, right? Lying's pretty obvious, right? But coveting, you can nearly cover that one up, can't you? That one's not necessarily so self-evident. But what if, in fact, that's the one that lies at the heart of all the rest of them? And I'm still turning that over in my mind. I'm not giving you that as an absolute, but I'm strongly leaning that direction, let's say. Okay? Yes. Okay. That's right. Barbara said that was the reason that Cain killed Abel. So the first murder, that was based on coveting. He had God's approval, right? Made him angry, and he coveted that. So he said, And you got to keep following through with his logic. And sometimes the sentence goes on and even goes across the period. I would not have known what sin was except through the law. I would not have known what it was to covet if the law had said, do not covet. So the problem is not law. What is the problem? Look at the first two words in verse 8. But sin. What is sin? Breaking the law. Problem is not the law. The problem is I break it. That's what brings the problem. It's not law that brings the problem, but breaking it. And he says in verse 8, but sin. Look at the first part of verse 11. For sin. In verse 13, by no means, in the middle of the verse. By no means, but in order that sin might be recognized. So the problem is not law. The problem is what? Sin. And that means I'm the problem, not law. I'm the one that breaks law. Now, watch what he teaches us some things about sin. This is really, really gives you some insight into law and our relationship to it. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment. And he's going to use that phrase twice in this. What opportunity did the law provide sin? Well, he's going to illustrate it. It produced in me every kind of covetous desire. For apart from the law, sin is dead. Remember our passage back in 1 Corinthians 15? Where does sin get its power or its strength? From the law. So he says, apart from the law, sin is dead. But I want to come back to this thought that the opportunity that the law provided sin, he said, it produced in me every kind of covetous desire. And I want us to see how that is an opportunity for sin. And by now, all of you have heard the illustration I'm about to use, but I can't think of one that's any better. If you can think of one, give me and I'll consider it. Here you are walking along one day in a local park here, and you're just bebopping along. Everything's fine, beautiful day, and you are walking by yourself, and you look over there, and there's a sign on the park bench over there. And the sign, you go over to, you can read it, and it says, wet paint, do not touch. Now, let me ask you what you're going to do. You're going to stop, and you're going to look around, see if anybody's watching. And what are you going to do? You're going to reach it and touch it. Why? See if it's still wet. Now, if that sign wasn't there, would you have gone over there and touched that bench? It would never have occurred to you. I mean, who goes around touching benches, right? You would never have had any kind of desire to go over there and touch that bench. But because there was a law, because it said don't touch, then all of a sudden, out of the blue, out of nowhere, where you didn't have a desire before, you now have a desire to touch that bench. And it's a strong desire. In fact, if you don't touch it, you're going to think about it for the next several hours, wondering if it was wet, aren't you? And so there's just something in our nature that we have to reach out and touch it. Now, bring that to this. But sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, produced in me every kind of covetous desire. Whenever we're told, do not do this under any conditions, what do we start thinking about? I wonder how it would be to do that. I bet it's fun. I bet it, you know, go back to Eve. Here they're just as happy as they can be. God's given them everything that they could possibly want and more. And he only said this one thing. That tree that's in the middle of the garden, don't touch it. Don't mess with it. Leave it alone. And they were happy with that until Satan came along and sin, taking the opportunity afforded by the commandment, worked in me all manner of evil desire. Satan used the commandment. Did God say to you that if you did this, this was going to happen? God's messing with you. You know why God doesn't want you to eat that fruit? Because God doesn't want you to be as smart as he is. Because if you eat that fruit of that tree, you're going to know everything God knows. You're going to be your own God. You're going to be as smart as God is. You can row your own boat. You don't have to depend on anybody. Sin took the law, and it found an opportunity to work evil desire in me that I otherwise didn't have. Now, isn't that an interesting thing about it? Now, here's the thing we have to... Does that make the law evil? Is the problem law? It's not the problem. What's the problem? Sin. And why would I sin because of law? Because he personifies sin. You know what personification is? It is to take something that is not alive, an inanimate object, and to give it the attributes of being alive. And so he personifies sin. Sin is not just this thing that's laying here and you can come by and you can pick it up and take it and put it in your pocket or not. Sin is alive. Sin is powerful. Sin is smart. Sin is out to get you. It's not just this inanimate thing in creation. It is a force. It is an extremely powerful force. And it gains its power from the law. The law, the downside of law is that it feeds the opportunity. The more laws you have, the more desires that you have. There's something in us that it creates within us, a desire to do something that's wrong, to break that law. Then he says, I was alive, once, verse 9, once I was alive apart from law. But when the commandment came, sin sprang to life and I died. Put that, what he just said, apply that to Adam and Eve. That's the simplest way to do that. Before this commandment came, he said, I was alive. But when it came, I found sin sprang to life. And my desire. There was a hand. Yes, sir. That's right. And it does, doesn't it? If there was one thing, I think if God could create in us one thing that would help us be the kind of people that he wants us to be, it would be an understanding of how horrible sin is. Because we don't really view all sin as being horrible. And we can't until we look at the cross and really let that soak in what the cross means in relationship to sin. And when we see the innocent Lamb of God dying in my place, then we begin to get a taste of the true reality of sin. And how terrible it must be from God's perspective to see the people that he's poured his love and mercy and grace out on go back and begin to participate again willingly, habitually in sin. What must that do to God? The very thing that cost his son his life. What must that do to him? And so, among the things that happens, and maybe one of the most important things that happens in this study, is we begin for the first time in our life. Now, the world tells us, everybody does it. You know, you just get all the little cliches that you want to throw in there. But the world makes nothing out of sin, right? It makes it even, it tries to make it even more enticing, and it puts really beautiful pictures up there. You know, and one of them, and I know it's an old one, but the old ad that used to have this beautiful picture of the cold, clear mountain stream, and this particular alcohol was a product of the brewer's art. And you had all this beautiful, beautiful scenery and this cold, clear water. And then this was the product of the brewer's art. What they need to show, if they're going to be honest, is they need to show a child that has been severely abused by a drunk parent. And they need to show somebody who's laying in a gutter with vomit all over him that was at one time a respectable person. And we start getting a picture, a truer picture of the product of the brewer's art. But the world's not going to show that. The world's going to make it attractive, isn't it? And so sin, taking occasion by the commandment, by the law, wrought in me all manner of evil desires. For I was alive once apart from law. I didn't think about touching that bitch. But then the law came. And it wrought in me all manner of evil desires. And then he says in verse 10, I died. I died when I sinned, when I succumbed to that temptation, that sin worked in me through the law. I foolishly participated in it, and I died. And I found that the very commandment that was intended to bring life actually brought death. Don't touch that tree. And all of a sudden, I began to think about how good it looked and how good it must taste and how beautiful it was and how much fun it would be to do that, and I go over there and I get it. And the commandment that was intended to bring life resulted in death. For sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, there's that phrase again, deceived me. How did it deceive me? It persuaded me that it was going to be fun, and it persuaded me that it was going to be good, and it persuaded me that it was beautiful and that it was desirable and that I really needed that and I was really missing out if I didn't do that. It persuaded me all those things. It deceived me. And so by the commandment, it put me to death. It baited the trap. It waved it in front of me, and I reached and grabbed it, and the trap sprung, and I was caught. And it's a killer. I died. It didn't just injure me. It didn't just injure relationships. I died. It took away my life. God had given me eternal life, and I sold it for a mess of stew. For a little of nothing when I look back at it. Was it fun? Did it taste good? Yeah, it did. So parents, don't tell your children that sin's not fun. They're going to find out you lied to them. It is fun. That's not the problem with it. The problem with it is there's a price tag on it. And the price tag is hidden. They won't put it out front. You ever go into a store somewhere and you pick something up and you start looking for a price tag, and that's going to depend on whether or not you're interested and there's no price tag on it? Satan's a master at that. He won't put the price tag on it. Or if he has to, he'll lie to you. You'll get up there to pay out and you find out that that really wasn't the price. The price is far, far more than that. You know, that's, you go by, I don't mean to be knocking in particular. You go by a car lot and it'll have a price printed out across the window of the car. And you go up there thinking, okay, I'm going to get this car for this much. Well, that's the down payment. There's a lot more. It's going to cost you. The devil's a master at it, isn't he? He's had lots of time. Besides that, he's smart. He's smarter than you are. He's smarter than I am. He knows how to do it. He's had lots of practice. He knows exactly what to say and when to say it. He knows when to be quiet, and he knows when to push it just a little bit. He knows when to flash it in front of you so that you see it. And all of a sudden, you start thinking about something you wouldn't have thought about before, something evil. We can all relate to that. Sometimes we're watching TV, and all of a sudden this scene comes on, and we know we shouldn't be watching this, but we watch it, and all of a sudden we're thinking about something we shouldn't be thinking about. Right? It happens to us regularly. I mean, you go to this movie that you think is a really nice movie for the family, and all of a sudden it's not. And in your children's brain and in your brain, something's been burned that you can't get out. Satan is a master at it. For sin, seizing the opportunity afforded by the commandment, deceived me and through the commandment put me to death. So then, the law is holy. The commandment is holy and righteous and good. Do we need law? Do we need God's law? Of course we need God's law. We wouldn't know what sin was except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. And we would have died never knowing that it was sinful and what the cost of it was. So law is absolutely necessary. We wouldn't know what righteousness looks like if God didn't give us his law. And he wrote it on our hearts, didn't he? The moral, eternal principles, he wrote on our hearts. And so God's law is good and righteous and holy and necessary. But sin used it in a way that God didn't design it to be used. And he trapped us. And we died. But that doesn't mean that the law is bad. So our question was, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? No. It's not the law. Law is not the problem. I'm the problem. And then verse 13, and it's still in connection with that same question. Did that which is good then become death unto me? Now that sounds like a pretty logical conclusion to what we just got through saying, doesn't it? If I was going to write up a conclusion to what we just said, I might write that one up. That might be the way I would summarize what we just said. Did that which is good then, what is it he's talking about, that which is good? The law. Become death unto me? By no means. But in order that sin might be recognized as sin. And we need to quit making up little soft names for sin. We need to call sin what sin is and not be intimidated by political correctness or anything else to call sin something other than what it is. It's not a little problem. It is death. And you're not doing yourself or anybody else any favor when you start talking about it's not so bad in any form. It is as bad as you can possibly imagine it to be. And it needs to be spoken of in terms that way. A.K.A. Phil Robertson. I'm not saying that he used the choicest, best words. But he put something that our society has said is good out there in terms that you couldn't mistake that it's not good. At least he believes that, didn't he? And so, again, I'm not saying he should have used all the words that he did, but I'm saying that he dared to go against the grain of our society and say, this is perversion. This is wrong. This is sinful. And the world tried to nail him to a cross. And for the first time in a long, long time, the tide got turned. Did that which is good then become death unto me? By no means. But in order that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me through what was good. What is it that makes us realize that sin is sin, that sin is horrible? What is it? It's the consequences that come from it. If there were no consequences that came from sin, we could just trip through our life thinking, well, it's not that big a deal. But when there are consequences to it, all of a sudden, we have to come face to face with, why did this happen? It happened because of sin. And if we're wise, we won't try to make excuses that it really wasn't because of that. Yes, it was because of that. There are consequences to sin. And if we soften those up, and that's what we're all about as a society. We're not concerned about the sin. We want to soften up the consequences. We want to do away with the consequences. And so we start making it legitimate. We start talking about it in terms as if it's not that bad. Yes, it is. It kills. And you're not doing yourself or anybody else any favor to talk in any terms other than that. I mean, if it were poison, if it were something that were deadly poison, and you started talking about, well, you know, it's not all bad. You know, you can take some. It's not all bad. Yes, it is. And let's be clear about it. We can go off from there, but I won't. Come back. Did that which is good become death unto me? No, but in order that sin might be recognized as sin, it produced death in me through that which is good. So that the commandment, through the commandment, sin might become utterly sinful. The commandment shows sin to be what it is. Is that a good thing? That's a good thing. We know that the law is spiritual. Now, you need to. This is one section of the Bible, and you've heard me say this in sermons before. Beginning in verse 14, if you want to start a Bible study with somebody and you're trying to figure out how to engage that person in a Bible study, one of the ways that you might consider is turning here to Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 14, and reading down through the end of the chapter. But I'm going to warn you, you have to practice reading this because it's not an easy read. Because it's kind of a tongue twister. And it really loses its effect if you don't read it properly, if you stumble and go back and stumble and go back. So you need to spend some time practice reading this and see what it says. Let me read it and then we'll pick up here again, Lord willing, next week. Verse 14. We know that the law is spiritual, but I'm unspiritual, sold as a slave to sin. I do not know what I'm doing. For what I want to do, I do not do. But what I hate, I do. And if I do what I do not want to do, I agree that the law is good. As it is, it's no longer I myself who do it, but it's sin living in me. I know that nothing good lives in me, that is, in my sinful nature. For I have the desire to do what's good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good that I want to do. No, the evil that I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it's no longer I who do it, but it's sin living in me that does it. So I find this law at work. When I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being, I delight in God's law. But I see another law at work in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am. Who will deliver me or rescue me from this body of death? And stop right there, because the answer is the next part. If you stop and let that soak in and understand what he just said, it's like him going to your mailbox and opening your personal mail, really personal mail, that you wrote. Because is there anybody here that doesn't relate to what he just said? What he said was, I know what's right, and I know what's good, and I try to do it, but when I try to do it, I just can't consistently do it. And the good that I want to do, I'm not able to do. And the things that I hate, and I promise God I'm never going to do that again, guess what? That's what I do. Now, can you not relate to that? Any sincere person can relate to that. Because that gets really down to where we live. And this is the man who's living under law. This is a man who's trying to be good. He's trying to be good enough to go to heaven. And that's most people who have any concern about spiritual things in the world. They're trying to be good. But we keep trying and we keep failing. And after a while, we get discouraged and we say, what's the use in trying? I just can't do it. And the truth is, that's where you're supposed to be. That's where the law is going to take you. It's going to teach you you can't be good enough to go to heaven. But the good news is, you don't have to be. And we'll stop right there. Thank you.